Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
And welcome to my wonderful, wonderful audience. I always like introducing the show to remind the folks who listen to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour that you are among the more enlightened, caring, informed, determined people, either professionals in the field of psychiatry, psychology, mental health in general, or people who have been in the field as clients and patients, some of whom among you have been badly injured. I just want to again express my gratitude for this show and my gratitude for the wonderful listeners across the world. I thought I don't do enough on this show to actually talk about my own work. So I just want to remind you all about my website, and I should probably do that every time, Bregan.com. And if you just go to Bregan.com and you look at the very top, which is in red print, selected highlights of Dr. Bregan's work, you'll find a whole bunch of interesting things, including my new article, my new peer-reviewed article, Rational Principles of Psychopharmacology, including my special section, which also has a new article in it, on why to never psychiatrically drug your child, another one on my testimony to Congress on psychiatric drugs being given to military, my video series, Simple Truths About Psychiatry, my whole list of scientific and psychological papers, which now is over 55 peer-reviewed publications, my relatively new resource center, Antipsychotic Drugs and Tardive Dyskinesia Resources Center, which has well over 100 articles put in categories with descriptive paragraphs and an introduction. I don't know how many hundreds of hours went into the development of that site, but it's there for a resource for families and psychiatrists and researchers around the world. There's nothing quite like it, so well organized. And finally, there's my radio show. And the unique thing about that, which you can click on, this is on my selective highlights of Dr. Bregan's work, you can click on listen to Dr. Bregan's weekly radio talk show. Now, it's on this wonderful station, PRN-FM, and it's archived on PRN-FM, and it's archived on Podbean, P-O-D-B-E-A-N, like beans, bean soup, so podbean.com. Going back a number of years now. And the thing about going to it through my website is that I've created a search mechanism. Now, my guest today is Joanna Moncrief. Joanna, are you there?
I'm here, yes. Hello, Peter.
Hi. Well, folks, Hi. You can go and you can look up, if you like this show, as I'm sure you will, you can go to the section on my website that says listen to Dr. Bregan's weekly radio show, and you can there, but nowhere else that I know of, search for the name of anybody you wanna follow up on. You'll find Joanna's been on the show a number of times, Joanna Moncrief. You'll find I had a series of four shows with Peter Goetze, the Danish physician who's becoming one of the most important people in the world as a researcher and as an educator on this subject. You'll find Bob Whitaker many times on the show if you look up Whitaker. So you can just find a lot of really good interviews that I've done, and they will just really introduce you into the world of what these people think, because I try to give my guests – the opportunity to really express themselves unfettered. So I need to do that more, is remind people of the kinds of things that I have on my website, because I've put so much time and effort into it, including having it completely redone in a new framework not very long ago, a matter of months ago, to make it more accessible and searchable, change the whole underlying framework of it. My guest today is Joanna Moncrief, and Joanna lives just outside of London and was in London today. And for those of you who are listening to the show today rather than on the podcasts, where the great majority of you actually end up listening, today is the day that there was the terror attack in London. So far, one individual that we know of driving his car across Westminster Bridge and knocking people down and causing many, many serious injuries. We have no idea what the casualties are at this point, and managing to get into Parliament buildings, I think, or onto the grounds, and where he killed a policeman and he was shot dead, and there are at least two other known dead and many injured. So I checked with Joanna earlier, and she's fine and safe, and I'm very delighted that she still wanted to go on with the show today. And the theme today for the next several shows is The Sedated Society, this book that's come out from Palgrave Macmillan by Davies, the editor, and with many of the top people in reform in psychiatry, like Joanna and like Peter Gertz and like Bob Whitaker, the same names I just mentioned by chance. We all have chapters in this book. It's probably the best academically oriented compendium of thoughtful presentations on issues in the field of psychiatry, I think. I want to have Joanna come on now, and she can talk about her chapter. She can talk about a follow-up on the research that she's been doing. So, hi, Joanna. Thanks for coming on today. Oh, I haven't told you who she is. She's such a good friend. I assume you all know her. She's a psychiatrist. That's the first time I've ever almost not introduced somebody. I think it's a sign of my affection for you, which I assume everybody knows and knows you and has. She's a psychiatrist, and she calls herself a part-time academic and author. And she's interested in many of the same things I am, history and the philosophy and politics of psychiatry. Actually, it sounds pretty much like me, and particularly the use and misuse and misrepresentation of psychiatric drugs. I think we're brothers and sisters here. She can tell you about how she became more interested in the whole psychiatric drug issue. But a lot of her conclusions and her thinking has paralleled mine, in that she is focused on what she calls the drug-oriented explanation of psychiatric drugs, which is to look at how they affect human beings rather than to start with a disease-centered model and look at the patient is mentally ill and cured by the drugs. She rather is looking at how the drugs work. I would say, I'm not sure she would go this far with me, but she is looking specifically at the drugs as neurotoxins, from my viewpoint. And it's kind of silly to look at the patient's response rather than what do neurotoxins do to people. She's been a really terrific critic of the chemical imbalances theory. And her drug-centered model, as she has written, is to, quote, highlight the nature of the drugs themselves, how they change the body and the brain. And so welcome to the show.
Thanks, Peter.
My condolences to you and to the people of Great Britain and London.
Yeah.
And hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I mean, obviously, it's a very sad day. I mean,
was in London, as you said. In fact, the bit of London I was in really wasn't affected, but obviously it was very sad news, and everyone is in a state of shock about it. But yeah, we carry on. We have to. So yeah, I mean, thanks for that introduction, Peter. And what you didn't say is that I borrowed my ideas or pinched my ideas from you, always with acknowledgement, of course. So you know, I've developed some of the ideas that you had about how drugs alter people, but not just people. They alter animals. They alter organisms. That's what drugs are. And I've tried to highlight that. And in the chapter that I did in the book you mentioned, The Sedated Society, I wanted to have a look at how we're using these drugs nowadays, these special drugs that work on the brain and therefore alter our mental functions and our behavior. Sometimes we refer to those drugs as psychoactive drugs. And I wanted to have a look at where we are with using those sorts of drugs nowadays. And of course, psychoactive drugs that act on the brain, includes some drugs that are prescribed by doctors, but also drugs that people take recreationally or illicitly. And I wanted to look at the history of where we are today, how we got here. And that history looks at the connections, in fact, between the use of prescribed drugs and non-prescribed drugs. And I think that helps explain why the situation that we have today. And I also wanted to look at how misinformation is put out about what the drugs that are prescribed for mental disorders are doing. And that misinformation, as you referred to, often takes the form of the idea that they're rectifying a chemical imbalance. And I think that idea has come about for a number of reasons, but also that because it's become so popular, it's actually obscuring what the drugs are doing, and it stands in the way of people actually having a more informed and more empowered relationship to mind-altering drugs. So
I'll just keep on. I'm listening and talk some more about this relationship of people to their drugs. It's critical.
Yeah, I mean, the shocking thing is that we are using more mind-altering prescription drugs today than we probably ever have done, even more than in the 1950s when there was a huge epidemic of barbiturate use, particularly among women, and in the 1970s when there were very high levels of use of drugs like Valium and Librium, the drugs that we call benzodiazepines, and amphetamines as well in the 60s and 70s. So use of those drugs was very high at that time. But at the moment, we are using even more antidepressant drugs. And if you add on to that our continued use of stimulants and sedatives like benzodiazepines, we're probably overall using more mind-altering drugs, certainly more prescription mind-altering drugs than we were back then. And I think that's quite shocking. And what's more shocking is that the use is going up and up. So, you know, it's not clear where we're heading to, and we could be heading to an even worse situation. And I think this situation has been partly brought about because of this idea of the chemical imbalance, and because that makes people think that taking these drugs must be a good idea, and it sort of obscures the dangers that are inherent in taking something that alters the body and alters the brain. And I was looking through my chapter.
As far as I know, as far as I can trace it, I don't know if you have any additional information. The biochemical imbalance theory really begins with Prozac and takes hold with Prozac. And I think it was probably an invention of the PR department at Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac. And that, you know, they were already having, before it was even an approved drug, they were already paying doctors to go out and talk about you know, how serotonin was an imbalance and drugs could cure it. So I think it may have begun with them. Do you have any different history than that?
No, I think there are the beginnings of it date back to the 1960s when people came up with, you know, possible biochemical series of mental disorders. So there was the
general theory was earlier, but they
weren't very widely publicized, and people were aware that these were theories at that time. You know, they were aware that the evidence was very sketchy and inconclusive. I think the thing that made the difference was the crisis over the benzodiazepines in the 1980s. So benzodiazepines were being very widely prescribed, and when it became apparent that they were just as addictive as the barbiturates and other drugs that had gone before, there was this big scandal because, of course, they'd been marketed as being less addictive, and people had been told that there wasn't the same addiction problem. And then people started to realize that actually coming off them was no picnic. It could be really difficult. And that threw the spotlight on benzodiazepine prescribing in general, and it became apparent that there were very high levels of benzodiazepine prescribing, and that often these drugs were just being dished out to unhappy people, you know, effectively just to keep them quiet or get them out of the office, particularly women, particularly middle-aged women. And so that created a crisis for the idea that you could prescribe drugs to obliterate someone's misery, to just sort of numb people. And that's why I think the pharmaceutical companies came up with the idea of the chemical imbalance. The chemical imbalance allowed them to present their new generation of drugs, which were the SSRIs, as something that was a sophisticated, targeted treatment, not something that was just going to numb you and, you know, quieten you down, basically, which is what it was obvious the benzodiazepines had been doing. So I agree with you. That's where I think it was our modern idea was invented, and certainly where it was publicized from.
This is all very interesting. And one thing that I wasn't so aware of, although I'm older than you by quite a bit probably, and I should have been, is how much phenobarbital was being used by women preceding the use of Valium. Mm-hmm. Would you tell us a little? Do you have more about that? I actually believe you. It makes absolute sense. And I'm just not sure I've learned much about that.
It's not very easy to find out about the use of barbiturates, but I did from somewhere find that about 6% of the American population were taking long-term barbiturates in the mid-50s. So that's quite a lot of people. And of course, barbiturates are really dangerous. You can easily overdose on them. And, you know, people like Marilyn Monroe did overdose on them. So there was concern about them. And that's partly why the benzodiazepines took off, because they produced some of the same effects but weren't quite as toxic in overdose.
And one of the other things that occurred to me as you were talking was, you know, it's widely accepted now, although you still see an occasional stupid doctor who doesn't, that the benzos are highly addictive and should only be given short term if you're going to use them at all.
Yeah.
But the other thing that now doctors, I think, are still being dumb about is that they do cause permanent cognitive deficits. And as your British colleague, I'm blanking on her name now, has written so much about, and as I've written a lot about, they produce these long-term cognitive deficits. People don't necessarily recover from what we used to think were withdrawal reactions from the benzos. They end up with persistent aches and pains and a variety of cognitive deficits and sometimes dementia.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the literature about dementia or cognitive deficits, but certainly I think it's increasingly accepted that you can get persistent withdrawal problems, although it's very difficult to find any official literature on this. But certainly the advice about helping
people email you a bunch of articles on dementia from the drugs. send them to you later.
Right.
There's quite a bit out there now.
I'll have a look at them, yes.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, no, but I think it is acknowledged that they can cause persistent withdrawal symptoms, especially if they're discontinued too fast. So there's more and more advice that they should be, you know, withdrawn very, very slowly, especially if someone's been taking them for a long time. And I think that's partly because there's this increasing recognition that especially if you take someone off too fast, they may have very severe and persistent withdrawal symptoms. But it's very difficult to find this in the literature. I mean, this is one of the problems, Peter, isn't it? There's so much enthusiasm for starting people on drug treatments and for finding new drug treatments, and very little enthusiasm for actually finding out carefully and systematically what they do in the long term. And, you know, this is just, that's not acceptable, is it, to have a system where we're, you know, churning out these new drugs and giving them to people, and people are being stuck on them for years, and we really just don't know what they do. And, you know, people like you and I are having to sort of read through the lines to find out. But really, there should be good quality research on their long-term effects done with animals and humans to make sure that they're safe and find out what they do to people.
So, well, yeah, they don't want to do the research. I think because all psychiatric drugs are neurotoxins, and we know that chronic exposure to neurotoxins cause permanent damage, and I think that's one of the reasons. And so I'm emphasizing now as much as I can that psychiatric drugs are psychiatric neurotoxins. They disrupt brain function.
Yeah.
They harm brain function. And that's the definition of a neurotoxin, folks, a drug that harms, interferes with, and even in the long run can destroy the functioning of the brain. It's just not good to take those kinds of agents, and especially in high enough doses to get a mental and psychological effect. Because once you've done that, you're already getting the gross neurotoxic effect once you get up to that level. So there's no small level, because once you get up to the level, and I've never put this so clearly, so I thank you for having the opportunity to talk with you about it, Joanne, and for folks out there, I've never put it so clearly, that once you get up to the sufficient level of a neurotoxin for it to affect your mental processes, you are intoxicated with the neurotoxin, and it is going to cause you long-term harm if you stay on it. Does that make sense to you, or is that too simple? Putting you on the spot. You can say it doesn't make sense.
I mean, all I would say is that, you know, human beings do use various drugs from time to time without there being substantial harm. You know, many of us use caffeine and drink alcohol now and again, and the body seems to be able to cope with that if you don't overload it. I think the worry is when you're ingesting drugs that, as you say, up to a level that they're affecting your behavior, and you're doing that every day, and that's when I think you can get into problems. And I suppose it's sort of quite emotive to use the word neurotoxin, but what I would certainly agree with you over is that these drugs they're altering the way that the mind works. They're changing the way that we normally function. And I was thinking about this today in relation to coming on this show, actually, that one of the effects that most mind-altering drugs have is they make us less sensitive to the environment, and particularly, I think, less sensitive to complex aspects of the environment, like other people and other people's emotions. And if you're constantly taking something that, you know, that dulls your ability to react, that's likely to affect how you function in the long term.
I like that formulation very much, to make you less sensitive to complex aspects of the environment. I think I'll quote you sometime on that line, such as other people. And
I was thinking about, because obviously different drugs have different sorts of mind-altering properties. So the effects that you get from amphetamine are different from the effects that you get from Valium, are different than from the effects that you get from a neuroleptic drug like Zyprexa or something like that, and then different again from so-called antidepressant drugs. They're all different. You know, they have different qualities to their effects. And some of them have this sort of emotional numbing effect, like the neuroleptic drugs, and opiate drugs as well do that in a different way. And I think the SSRI antidepressants do that too. But some of them make people more emotional, like alcohol or benzodiazepines. So they affect people in different ways. But I think what's common to all of them, as I was saying, is that when you're in this drug-altered state, you are less able to deal with complex phenomena, less able to react quickly and creatively to your environment, and particularly to those bits of your environment that require you to be particularly astute.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Because I mean, that's based. I apologize for the sound.
No, it's all right. I mean, that's based a lot on your writing, you know, about the intoxicating effects of mind altering drugs.
Yeah, and the way thank you for that. And the way I'm thinking about it more and more is very much what you just said. And in an effort to kind of find code words that people can grasp and communicate about them, I've been lately calling them not caring drugs. And maybe I'll find a better word. But one of the things that all these, I'll persist in saying neurotoxins, what all these psychiatric neurotoxins do is they make people care less.
Yes.
And
yes.
Sometimes that's a relief for other people.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a relief for the person.
Yeah.
But it isn't a good solution long term.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when we're distressed, many people might want some sort of brief relief from that, whether that's produced by a drug or whatever. You know, I think that is a natural way to feel. And in my chapter in the Sedated Society, I'm looking back at how people used alcohol in that way and used opium in that way, particularly in the 19th century. There were very high rates of opium, and people could just go and buy it from the corner shop and self-medicate. So it does seem to be a human inclination to take a mind-altering substance for many reasons, but one reason for taking them is to try and numb feelings of distress, reduce feelings of distress when people are particularly upset.
Yeah, it's an anesthetic in a way. Most anesthetics, folks, are closely related to or are benzodiazepines. So you just give enough of a drug that doesn't make you care as much, and eventually you're actually in a state of coma and anesthesia. I think that this is one of the themes I want to explore in the rest of my will be the rest of my work, but at least the next phase of my work to some extent is looking at the fact that we are making tens, hundreds of millions of people less caring, and in your terms, less able to deal with complex phenomena such as other people. So what is it? What are the implications of doing this on a level of tens of millions of people, starting and including our children? What does this mean? It's got to have a vast political effect as well as huge personal effects.
Well, I think the political effects are really significant. I mean, certainly since the crash, I've been seeing the economic crash, been seeing more and more people in very difficult economic situations, coming for help from their going to see their local family doctor or their psychiatrist, because they're desperate and they don't know where else to go. And giving them an antidepressant really isn't going to sort out the problems they're struggling with, but it's a way of it appearing that something has been done. And a way, I suppose, a way of society sort of letting itself off the hook a bit. But I think it's a very political issue. I wanted to talk about antipsychotics. Have we got time for that before the break?
I've been doing breaks for a few months. I just value the time so much. So, yes, let's go to antipsychotics, because they're the model. They're the model for the first great not caring drug, and the pioneers in it. I've been doing. You wrote a wonderful article about this, and I wrote. You know, I wrote some books really looking at this earlier, and now I'm looking at. I've been looking at it once again, which is the origins of the neuroleptics, and how the key early on was the production of indifference.
Yeah,
and that indifference made the nurses on their wards appreciate this new drug with the first dose or two. And DeLay and Deniker make these observations that, well, one of the real signs we had was within the first day or two, the nurses loved the drug. And why did they love the drug? The patients were docile, easier to manage, and they also weren't showing so much suffering. Though eventually they end up suffering a lot more, and some of that gets documented in the early years. But here, I didn't mean to steal your.
That's part of what I was going to say. As you say, the what we now call antipsychotics, and they used to be called neuroleptics, which is a much better name because it means seizing, restricting the nervous system. And they were actually, in the early days, they were also sometimes referred to as neurological inhibitors, which is
Joanna, they were also called neurotoxins.
They talked openly about
the neurotoxic effects.
Yeah.
They were so excited about it because, you know, they learned that took them till 1957, about 3 years before DeLay and Deniker realized that the effects were the same as those of lethargic encephalitis, which also struck the basal ganglia and the entire brain. And at that point, they were comparing the neurotoxic effects of lethargic encephalitis with the neurotoxic effects of the drug and writing about it for a few years. And then that fell quickly out of vogue.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? One of my favorite articles by Pierre Deniker, the Frenchman who was using them in these early days, as you mentioned, is an article where he talks about the neurological syndrome that these drugs produce in very graphic and honest terms. And he says, basically, this is a form of Parkinson's disease, similar to Parkinson's disease, where people slow up and show restricted movement and restricted thought processes. And I suppose the point I wanted to make is that I do think that their effects can be useful when someone is acutely psychotic. If someone's so preoccupied by psychosis and emotionally very invested in their psychosis, that effect of emotional disengagement that these drugs produce can be quite useful. But the trouble is that in the long term, if you're cutting someone off from their emotions and dampening down their initiative and their creativity, you may end up doing more harm than good. And there is some evidence that people's long-term functioning is reduced by being on these drugs for long periods of time.
Their lives and their functioning.
So the same effect that can be beneficial in the short term can, sometimes be harmful in the long term. And this is the problem, isn't it? If we don't recognise what these effects are, then we won't be on the lookout for the damaging long-term effects.
Yeah.
And I think that's the state we've got into because, you know, even in the 60s and 70s, people were writing about... people were... Leading psychiatrists were expressing their concerns about the extent of the use of antipsychotics on a long-term basis and were worrying about the extent of their neurological side effects and thinking that maybe they were doing more harm than good. And that debate just disappeared, didn't it, over the last couple of decades?
Well, yeah, although I think there's no doubt that the professionals in psychiatry, especially in the U.S., where so much of the leadership is, they were just bought by the drug companies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's just no question about that, that every time some doctor would come out and be critical, I know one in particular, I won't mention his name, wrote a couple of really good articles on tardive dyskinesia, and he got hired by a drug company, and he never again wrote about tardive dyskinesia. And at least two of the people in my old Center for the Study of Psychiatry, when they were talking about adverse drug effects, both of them psychologists, not even psychiatrists, and they were approached by drug companies and offered $100,000 jobs if they would just go into some other research and work for the drug company. So they actually get in there indirectly. I want to just for the sake of my audience and not to mislead anybody, Joanna and I disagree about, to some extent, about, well, maybe a lot of extent, about the early use of antipsychotic drugs. I don't believe that controlled clinical trials, good ones, honest controlled clinical trials, show any advantage of antipsychotic drugs. And in particular, if you judiciously just help people with more mild doses of plain old sedative drugs to get some sleep during these torturous times, they do very, very well. The group in Finland, which people can look up, go to this folks, by the way, it comes from working 13 hours a day for 2 days on a legal case, actually for about 3 days, I think. Open Dialogue. You look at Open Dialogue, and they rarely use drugs with acute psychosis. They work with the whole family, and when they do use drugs, they usually just use a benzo for a few weeks to help people get through. And there are early studies showing that if you're going to choose between drugs, benzos are as good for just helping people quiet down, and they just know as near as horrific in their side effects or as dangerous short term. And my experience is that you can work with acutely psychotic people and help them get through it rather quickly if you have the family cooperation. But if they're enmeshed in a difficult, conflicted family that wants them on drugs, that's hard. Impossible, maybe, to do it without drugs. But if you have a family that wants to work with you, that with a 17- or 18-year-old who's psychotic, I'm able to help people with manic episodes. Manic episodes. You're not supposed to be able to help anybody in a manic episode by talking to them. But if you've got a parent working with you who will stay with the person, I mean, you might be able to end a manic episode in a few days by working with a family member. Not always. And then it becomes, you know, a problem, obviously. I want to just emphasize the importance of family interventions, which is what they do in Open Dialogue. They go right to the home. So I think you and I have a little different take on that. Maybe because I'm in private practice and can do it which way I want, which would be harder for you in a hospital setting.
I agree with you to the extent that I think we really need to minimize the use of these drugs. And I think we need to you know, if someone's having a psychotic episode, we need to give them, we should, in an ideal world at least, be giving them the opportunity to see whether they can get through that episode without using antipsychotic drugs in the way that you're describing, involving the family, having some sort of, you know, not too intrusive, supportive contact with people, and maybe occasional use of a general sedative. And I think that should be our first line approach, and that we should reserve the use of antipsychotics for people who don't recover in that way and are persistently and very severely psychotic, in which case I do think that they should be tried. But I agree with you that, you know, people can come through a psychosis without the use of drugs. It's like you mentioned, it's difficult to do that in healthcare systems that are have been structured around the use of drugs, and often, you know, it's difficult to have the space and the time and the care for someone to be able to, you know, work through their psychosis without using antipsychotics.
Yeah. I think one of the most important things, folks, and Joanna and I were talking about this before the show, is the one of the biggest problems we face in treating people without antipsychotic drugs or trying to help them come off antipsychotic drugs is the environment now. The professional environments have been totally trained that you can't do it. And, of course, they will have to work a little harder, relating to the patient rather than managing the patient. So if you have a patient who's in a nursing home or a foster care home or a home care facility or in a household where people have been taught that the person needs drugs and they know when they get the drugs, at least for a while, they're calmer, even though they experience them getting a lot of terrible outbreaks usually later on. But that one of the real reasons for the failure nowadays to succeed in getting people off psychiatric drugs or treating them without psychiatric drugs is that the families are so frightened because of the educational propaganda they've been given about doing it. And if you have a human being who feels vulnerable and scared and you think that they can be helped without medications, and their family is very anxious about that, they're going to get that anxiety and they are not going to be able to come off drugs or to be treated without drugs. So my experience has so much to do with the family in both acute psychosis and also acute manic episodes. I've had more recent experience with that, of being able to help people get through them back to a state of normality when there's just a really cooperative family who's going to continue what I'm teaching them and continue it, including being with the person for the whatever time is needed. I thought I'd share that experience with
you. I suppose the problem is that for many families, you know, that might be very difficult to do, especially if the episode goes on for quite a long time. And that's why
I think ideally we
ought to have, you know, some sort of treatment units where people can go, but not necessarily be drugged, to give
families
a break.
Well, and have a nice family. That's what we need. We need treatment units that function like a loving family.
Yeah. And what worries me is that our institutions are geared up to being very short term, so that, you know, they want short term results. They want to keep people quiet here and now, so that they don't cause trouble and they don't go into hospital. But actually, by doing that, in the long term, they're potentially storing up problems in, you know, the sort of problems we've been talking about, in reducing people's functioning, worsening people's physical health, making people more dependent, giving people, you know, people have, as you say, breakthrough symptoms or further episodes despite drug treatment. So in the long term, there are all these problems. In the short term, you're just keeping people quiet and keeping people out of hospital, keeping, you know, using as few resources as possible.
Yes.
And that's very sad. And I think health services need to take a much longer view and try and think about the long term, mainly from the point of view of the patients. They're trying to, you know, trying to help improving their quality of life in the long term, but also from the point of view of services and society. You know, we have to minimize the harm that we do to people over the long term, and make sure that we're maximizing their ability to live rewarding, fulfilling, and independent lives.
You know, talking to you makes me think about something I've never before thought about, which is that because it is so difficult for many families to provide any kind of in-home caregiving from themselves, that we ought to make a part of insurance, whether it's government in your country, or now it's becoming more and more governmental in our country, whether it's private insurance, make it more and more possible for two things. One, for a family member to stay home, like kind of maternity leave. For a family member to stay home with an acutely disturbed family member for 30 days or 2 weeks as a part of insurance, and or to provide what in-home care of trained nurses or aides or other people who could help at home people in crisis. We would save so much money for insurance, for the government. We would end so much misery more quickly, more readily, without the very toxic agents. I'd never really thought about that specifically, if we could include that into insurance, health insurance, that could make a huge deal. And I'm not sure in the long run it would even increase the cost of health insurance in the long run. It would immediately other things caught up. But I mean, the savings would be huge for not going into hospitals. I mean, I routinely see people who, if they were treated by any other psychiatrist I know of in the United States, pretty much, they would just be committed or quickly sent to a hospital. But especially if there's a cooperative family, they can often be treated very successfully outside the hospital.
But we haven't quite put it together
like that before.
Yeah, but we have home treatment teams in this country who go and treat people in their homes, but they're still just administering drugs, essentially. So it also involves, I think, a change in social mindset so that people prioritize trying to avoid drug treatment rather than just, you know, going to it as the first step. And then I think as part of that sort of different thinking, then it could be very helpful. So I just wanted to mention my research project that I think I mentioned when I last came on.
We talked about it quite a lot a few months ago. I want you to catch us up.
Yeah, so that's about trying to help people who are on long-term antipsychotic drugs to see if they can come off them in a gradual and supported way with professional support. And it's a randomized, the main part of the study is a randomized controlled trial, and we're going to randomize people either to sort of regular maintenance treatment or to this gradual reduction process, which they'll do with their doctor. And we'll be looking at the outcomes, both in terms of relapse, but our main outcome is social functioning. We want to see if helping people to come off these drugs actually can make people more independent and more active and be able to lead more rewarding lives. And we really need to do this study to get treatment right, because at the moment, as I said, the sort of knee-jerk reaction is that people are just continued on their medication for years and years and not given the option to try and come off. But then there was this study in the Netherlands that showed that a few years down the line, people who'd been given the option to come off slowly and gradually were doing quite a bit better than people who'd just been randomized to the maintenance treatment in the first place. So that's why we're doing the study, to try and see whether we can replicate those findings and to try and work out what the best strategy for long-term treatment is. And yeah, I think it's just really important because there are, as you've said, there are so many negative consequences of taking these drugs like antipsychotics on a long-term basis. You know, these this neurological problem called tardive dyskinesia, but also metabolic problems. People put on a lot of weight and they get diabetes and they get hypercholesterolemia, which is all much more likely to give them heart attacks and heart disease. So we really shouldn't be giving people these drugs unless we've got very good evidence that they are a good thing. And we're doing this trial, which is called the RADAR study, I should say. That stands for Research into Antipsychotic Discontinuation and Reduction. And we're doing this trial to try and work out what the benefits and harms of long-term antipsychotic treatment are and whether we could justify rolling out a program of trying to help people come off these drugs more widely than is done at the moment.
I'm so glad you're doing this. I'm so glad you're doing it.
Yeah, so it's just starting up. And the preliminary work we've done has been interesting. So we've been just surveying patients about their views about long-term medication. And most patients, it turns out, you know, are quite unhappy about the idea of taking medication forever and would like at least at some point to have a go at coming off it. And so we're hopeful that we'll get people into the trial and be able to give some of them in the trial an opportunity to do that. And also another finding that we found is that there are an awful lot of people in services in the UK, I don't know if it's the same in the US, who have been on these drugs for so many years. So the average time that the people we've interviewed have taken antipsychotics for was 18 years. That was the average time.
Oh, so, God.
Yeah, so, you know, people are being stuck on these things for a very significant portion of their lives. And we really need to make sure that, well, to work out whether that's the right thing to do or not. And if it's not, to come up with an alternative.
Well, so, yeah, and of course, folks, one of the reasons they're on them for so long is because withdrawal from antipsychotic drugs can be absolutely horrific. One of the things that happens when people try to come off is that they get the suppressed symptoms of tardive dyskinesia begin to break out, enormous anxiety, terrible anxiety breaks out, which also can be accompanied by tardive dyskinesia or by itself. They begin to perceive more clearly that they have been undergoing a dementing process, that they're not thinking as clearly, and because now they're aware, now they're caring. You see, they're coming off the not caring drug, so now they're caring and they're realizing that they've been harmed. It just can be terrible. People get terrible pains in their bodies of various kinds. They can develop akathisia, which is literally inability to sit still, but it's like being tortured from the inside out, and it's very agitating, very destructive. So that's one of the main reasons people are on them that long, and then they're told that usually by their doctors in the U.S., and I'm sure pretty much in Great Britain, that this means they need to stay on the drugs rather than, hey, we're just doing all this harm with the drugs. This is going to be difficult, but we'll work with you and we'll taper you off over a sufficiently long period of time if necessary, or in hospital if necessary.
Yeah.
Your thoughts about the experience of withdrawal in terms of the suffering it caused. Do you see the same way I do, Joanna?
Well, antipsychotics are unusual. I mean, Yes, sometimes I see some of those effects, but sometimes people come off without too much of a problem and actually feel better. But sometimes they've then, as you say, they've got to adapt to actually sort of waking up a bit, having been in this, you know, semi-sleep on the drugs for years and years, and sometimes that can be psychologically difficult for people. And people do, of course, sometimes, you know, have a relapse of their psychosis. And then,
yeah, I forgot to mention that they get a relapse of theirs, or worse, new psychosis, even worse.
Yeah, yeah, and there's the whole issue that it does look as if coming off long-term treatment increases your risk of having a relapse above what it might have been had you not been on long-term treatment in the first place. The evidence for lithium is pretty strong in that regard, isn't it? And I think it's there's probably some sort of effect like that with antipsychotics as well. And so, you know, hopefully gradual reduction will reduce that risk. That's why we're...
Yeah.
Because all the previous...
Folks,
studies,
if you go to my tardive dyskinesia... Mm. Well, it's actually antipsychotic drug and tardive dyskinesia resources, all of which is free. Everything on the website's free unless you buy a book. If you go to the Tardive Dyskinesia Resource Center, you'll see a section on tardive dementia and tardive psychosis, which will give you a look at some of, maybe a lot of, the best research out there going way back to the 70s or 80s with Canadian studies showing that there's a really serious issue with withdrawal from the antipsychotic drugs. So you can find the research there.
I know that well, Peter, and have quoted your articles on it many times. I think maybe I'm seeing a bit less of that at the moment, and maybe it's because we're not using quite as high doses of antipsychotics standardly as we used to.
You're not as crazy in Great Britain and Europe. All of Europe is a little less crazy in that they tend to give doses that are quite a bit lower than ours. And, of course, that is a good thing. It's not as good as not using them at all. But they probably, and many Europeans think, they're getting lower rates of tardive dyskinesia, tardive withdrawal, because they're simply using lower doses. From my viewpoint, the less of a toxin, the better.
Yeah.
And but it doesn't sound as if you're using them any shorter term than we are.
No.
From
no,
what you
I
just told
right.
me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think, and it's not just antipsychotics. I mean, antidepressants, you know, people are taking these for years and years nowadays. It seems that most classes of prescribed psychotropic drugs have a tendency to get prescribed, you know, year on year, indefinitely.
Indefinitely, basically, yeah. Mm. Joanna, we've gone through a length of a whole show here. We've got about a minute left. I want to thank you for what I think is one of the most thoughtful conversations I've had. And it's so good to talk to a colleague who has benefited so much from my work, but clearly is doing your own thinking and doesn't just agree with me in everything by any means. So it's such a delight to know you're in this world, and that you come on the show. And I just want to thank you a great deal for being on today. And you can have a closing few words if you like. The music's going to start any minute now.
It was a pleasure, as usual, Peter. Really enjoyed it, and we'll continue sometime in the future, maybe.
Oh, definitely. I want you to be more and more of a regular on the show, if you can bear it. And let me close by expressing all the compassion I can for the people of London. I know how terrifying these things can be. My wife and I were in Washington, D.C. when the plane flew into the Pentagon, and it changed our lives and changed a lot of how we felt about things. So you know, my deepest sympathy and understanding for you, Joanna, and for the people of London and Great Britain. And thanks for being on the show on this day.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.